The Solid Monster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Seth, you haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
This is episode 282 of The Solid Monster Sounds Off here on SEScoops.com and Stitcher Radio for Sunday, July 7th, 2013. We'll do This Week in Wrestling History at the end of the show, but it was on this day 4 years ago, July 7th, back in 2009, that I recorded episode 75 of The Sound Off, which is probably the one Sound Off I get asked about the most, that people bring up the most as one of their favorite shows or their favorite show, the infamous Michael Jackson rant. Wasn't very happy with the media coverage of his death, the circus that ensued, and I let my feelings be known, so they are there for your listening pleasure. You can actually still find episode 75 if you go to thesolomonster.com and scroll back. I think it was about a year later, which would have been July of 2010, if you go back in the archives on the right-hand side and search. So if you want to go back and listen to that, you can do so after you listen to this week's show. We got a big show this week to talk about. I did go to the TNA live event in Brooklyn Friday night. Have some thoughts on that. Raw, Impact, some ROH news, mailbag. Got a lot of stuff this week. I'm actually going to start out just really briefly some quick UFC thoughts from last night. And the reason I bring this up, UFC 162, big main event, Anderson Silva, the Spider, defending his middleweight crown against Chris Weidman. And this was a finish straight out of the pro wrestling playbook here. Weidman is the new UFC middleweight champion, knocking out Anderson Silva in the second round, one of the most shocking finishes in UFC history. Silva showed absolutely no respect for his opponent, and he paid the price for it. But I can't help but think that for a main event that people are paying a lot of money to see, and for a guy who is regarded as if not the best, one of the best fighters in history, you know, you expect both men to be at their best. And it was a finish that people are going to remember for the rest of their lives. But I feel like in some ways it was a cheap win. And that sucks. You know, maybe Weidman really is better than Silva. You know, we'll never know. Especially if Silva sticks to his guns and doesn't want a rematch. I don't care what he says now. There's going to be a rematch at some point. You know, they always say, oh, you know, I'm going to retire. I don't want the rematch. I'm done fighting. Believe me, there'll be a rematch at some point. There's too much money being left on the table. But it almost felt like Silva was begging Weidman to knock him out, like he wanted to lose. And I'm not saying he did want to lose. I'm just saying that's kind of how it came off. Look, I mean, with all the work these guys put in their training camp, I can't believe that he would do all that work and all that training just to flush it down the toilet on purpose. But this was a total pro wrestling finish here to this fight. Maybe that was Silva's way of putting him over. You know? I don't know what to believe. On Tuesday, WWE.com posted the following announcement. They said, in accordance with its talent wellness program, WWE has suspended Jesus Rodriguez, known as Ricardo Rodriguez, for 30 days, effective immediately for his first violation of the company's wellness policy. There is no official word on what Ricardo was suspended for. The rumor seems to be that he may have been taking fat burners. One indie wrestler who was good friends with him posted the fat burner theory online, and then she quickly took the post down. Another wrestler actually had this to say in a Facebook post. He said, so weird that some WWE superstars get arrested for DUIs, pot, and other illegal activity and don't get suspended, yet fat burners from GNC get you 30 days. Well, look, if he's talking about the swagger thing, I agree. The guy got arrested and was never punished by WWE. That was complete BS. But in their defense, and you could probably go on the WWE corporate website, I think they have the whole talent wellness policy posted and updated on there. Pot is not something that you are suspended for. If you get popped, then you get fined. I think it's something like $2,500 per offense. Now, I don't know if there's a threshold by which if you get fined X number of times, you then get suspended. I'm not aware of that. But you don't get suspended for smoking dope. But, you know, it looks like there's a double standard here. I mean, sure. You know, if I were in his shoes, I'd probably be frustrated also. And again, he's speaking for his friend. Ricardo has not said anything about this publicly. So he's taking the 30-day vacation, and it's just, I guess, a lesson to everybody who works for that company. You got to check ultra hard what you're putting in your body. Double check, triple check. You know, if he's telling the truth, it sucks. It's a shitty situation for him to be in. I don't know, you know, he obviously loses a lot of money for whatever time he's not working over the next 30 days. And he just has to be more careful, I guess, with what he puts in his system. They did an injury angle a few weeks back on SmackDown, which would explain the suspension news. So Alberto will be flying solo, obviously, for the Money in the Bank pay-per-view coming up. Another big piece of WWE news I just want to touch on here, and this concerns the ongoing McMahon storyline. This was a little nugget from this week's Wrestling Observer. Apparently, the whatever is planned for this McMahon angle, and I've said before, I'm not really a fan of what they're doing with the McMahons. You know, some weeks it's mildly interesting, but for the most part, I don't really, you know, everything being centered around Vince and Stephanie and Triple H, I thought the idea with Triple H was just to kind of use him for a special program like they did with him and Brock, or him and Taker. If you go back a little bit further, he gets on TV a little bit during the year, but he's not on camera as much as he is off camera. I mean, unless they're just going to make him the GM or something, I just don't see the need to have Triple H on TV every week. But apparently they have a plan. What this plan is exactly, nobody seems to know. The rumor seems to be that this is leading to a heel turn for all of them, including Triple H. That the McMahons will be portrayed, I guess, as the villains at some point. I don't know if there'll be an actual turn, if they're going to do something, to actually turn on somebody, like a big baby face on the roster. That I don't know. But whatever plan they have, it ties into next year's WrestleMania main event. And when I hear McMahons and WrestleMania main event, I can't help but think of WrestleMania 2000. And I shudder, because we don't need the McMahons linked in with whatever the main feud or program is for the WrestleMania main event. I think they could sell the WrestleMania main event on its own without having Vince or Stephanie, or God forbid, Triple H involved. And one interesting line from this item that was in the Observer this week was people who were very upset at the fact that you had a non-full-time person like The Rock or Brock Lesnar prominently featured in the big main event matches of WrestleMania this year, and even the year before. A lot of people very upset. Those people apparently will be upset again based on what is currently planned for the WrestleMania main event next year. What that means, I don't know. The rumors were that they were hoping for a Brock Lesnar-Rock match. Rock got hurt. Rock has apparently not made a decision one way or the other on whether or not he's going to continue wrestling. I would be shocked. I don't see what the big speculation is here. I'm 100% convinced that we have not seen The Rock's last match. I guess that doesn't mean he'll be at Mania next year. I'd be stunned if he wasn't. So if The Rock comes back, they can do the match with Brock. But then there's talk, well, maybe Undertaker and Lesnar. So I don't know that they know, for example, what Rock or Brock will be doing. But when I hear this, and I hear the rumors maybe of the McMahons going heel, Triple H going heel, and people will not like what they have planned for this WrestleMania main event next year, and I haven't read this anywhere, I don't know that this is necessarily the direction they're going in, but it made me think that perhaps they could be going in the direction of a Triple H versus Rock match at WrestleMania next year. And I thought about that a little bit, and you know, I don't necessarily like the idea of Triple H being involved in the top one or two matches at Mania, because I don't think he has to be. But the idea of doing a Rock-Triple H match based off, let's say, their previous history together, because they together had one of the greatest feuds in the history of that company. I thought their series of matches from like 98 through 2000 were terrific. And they helped carry that company when Steve Austin went down with a neck injury. You go back and watch WWF in the year 2000, it was The Rock and Triple H show for pretty much the entire year. And they had some tremendous matches against each other. The last match, I believe, that they ever had was on Monday Night Raw. I think it might have been the go-home show to SummerSlam back in 2002. I think they kind of knew this could be the last time, so we'll just put it on TV as a TV main event. And that would have been in August of 2002, so it was over a decade. The last time Rock and Triple H stepped in the ring together. You know, I actually wouldn't mind seeing the match. I wouldn't want that to be the main event. It could certainly be one of the two or three promoted main events on the show. I don't want that to be the last match on the card at the Superdome next year, but I actually would not be against the idea of a Rock-Triple H match. I would be kind of intrigued by it. I think the two of them work well together. I think they have a history on camera. They also have a history off camera. There's been a lot of rumors over the years, you know, that very competitive back in the day behind the scenes. Triple H was not very fond of The Rock. There was a professional jealousy there, and there was. I remember the NWO when they tried to resurrect it. And they had, I think it might have been the night that Shawn Michaels superkicked Booker T right out of the NWO. And Michaels was making comments about, you know, The Rock, you're like The Rock trying to steal Hunter's thunder. Some bullshit. You know, the click, everybody in the click always came off to me as being so insecure about their positions. And I never could understand why that is, because all of them were big stars, all of them were future Hall of Famers, but they always came off as sounding so petty and so jealous and then ragging on The Rock because he was all successful and stuff. So I kind of like the idea of maybe that playing into it as well. I think Rock and Triple H now get along just fine. I don't think they're bosom buddies or anything like that, but there, you know, you could really play this match up in a lot of different ways, with Rock being the babyface and Triple H being the heel. I wouldn't mind seeing the two of them one-on-one again. It's been 12 years, 13 years, something like that, since we've seen them in the ring together. Actually, maybe 11 or 12 years. I have no idea if that's what they're going for, but to kind of keep Triple H away from everybody else, I wouldn't mind seeing the match. And then you could do Brock and Taker, even though I still would like to see Cena Undertaker. But I don't believe this is going to be Undertaker's last match, so there's still maybe time to do that a year or two down the road. So I'm mildly curious now to see where this McMahon thing goes, and I almost hope they do go that way, with them, you know, embracing the heel side so that Rock come back, and again, I don't know how you get to that point. I guess there's a couple of different ideas you can come up with, but the idea of Rock versus Triple H at WrestleMania, which we never had a singles match between them at WrestleMania. It's kind of surprising given the rivalry they had. They opted to do the four-way match in 2000, which I thought was a mistake. I thought that match wasn't a bad match, but that was not worthy of being a WrestleMania main event. WrestleMania that year should have been Rock versus Triple H. Instead, they did the match 1 month later, I guess, to drag it out a little bit. So maybe we'll get the first Rock Triple H singles match of Mania next year. I guess we'll see. Monday Night Raw this week emanated from Sioux City, Iowa, perhaps for the final time. This was a live account from one person who was actually in the arena in Sioux City. He sent this into the website PW Insider. He said, as you probably noticed, the crowd was dead all night, except for when they were doing weird things like chanting for the announcers. I couldn't tell you why they acted that way, but it was pretty embarrassing. I doubt WWE wants to come back here anytime soon. I don't blame them, either. This crowd sucked. Let's do the good, the bad, and the ugly here for Raw. We'll start with the good. There was a match here between The Shield and Christian and the Usos, a six-man tag. The Shield six-man tags are a guilty pleasure of mine, still, after all these months. They're just really fun, and this match was actually really fun. Too short, though. Didn't go very long. I'm used to those Shield six-mans going like 20 minutes, 22 minutes. This didn't come close to that, but Ambrose got the pin on Christian in the end. He got revenge for Christian pinning him in the previous six-man tag they had on SmackDown a few weeks ago. And so this furthers their feud. I assume this is all going to lead to a U.S. Championship match between the two of them at SummerSlam, which I look forward to seeing. They also announced the Usos and the Shield tag team title match at Money in the Bank will actually be taking place on the pre-show. That sucks. I feel bad for those guys. You know, they deserve a spot on the pay-per-view. And I swear, you know, since The Shield won all of those belts, it's done nothing but bring them down. I swear. I mean, the Intercontinental, the U.S., the tag team belts, those things, the way they're treated in WWE, those things are like poison to whoever comes in contact with them. So, yeah, Shield relegated from main event status to the pre-show on the next pay-per-view. CM Punk and Curtis Axel had a tag team match against the Primetime Players. Good match, so I'll put it in the good column, but crowd didn't really care much for it. They told a story here with Punk not trusting Curtis Axel. Finish saw Punk deliver a go-to-sleep to Darren Young. Titus ran in. Punk disposed of him. But, you know, one of those deals where Axel then reaches over and tags Punk from behind, and Axel scurries into the ring, steals the pin, gets the victory for the Heyman guys. So just another step in the breakup of Punk and Heyman, and to build to the match with Lesnar at SummerSlam. And as far as Brock Lesnar goes, by the way, I don't know if Brock will be at the pay-per-view in Philadelphia. I'll be in Philadelphia for the pay-per-view, so I hope he makes an appearance. But he is scheduled for the Barclays Center the next night from Monday Night Raw, the first Raw in Brooklyn. So that is Brock's next scheduled appearance. Again, barring any surprise appearances at the pay-per-view. Cody Rhodes and Antonio Cesaro had a match. Crowd didn't care because it was two heels against each other, which was my fear with this whole Money in the Bank thing they have with all baby faces in one, all heels in the other. I'm sure they'll both be tremendous matches, but I wonder about the crowd reaction. If you got a ring full of all heels, you may just have a crowd that doesn't know what to do or who to react for. Jack Swagger is back. He was out there in Cesaro's corner with Zeb Coulter. JBL actually had an awesome line here when he said, Cesaro speaks five languages, and with Zeb Coulter, now he's learning Dutch. I thought that was great. Cody lost to the Neutralizer. Damian Sandow, who was in his corner, did not look pleased at all. Looked very disappointed. I'm putting this in the good column because I'm hopeful this means they're not just breaking up the Rhodes Scholars only to put them back together again, but they may actually turn Cody babyface and do something with him. I still think he would make for a nice dark horse winner in the Money in the Bank match, but you know, either way, the guy deserves better. Cody was always the one with legacy. I know DiBiase was the one people always said, oh, he's being groomed to be a big star. John Cena once in an interview said that within 2 or 3 years, I could see, you know, myself against Ted DiBiase in a WrestleMania main event, which is laughable now looking back on it. I always thought the real guy from legacy, I mean, Orton was already a made man, that had the most potential to break out was Cody Rhodes. I was impressed with him the first time I saw him when he did the Hall of Fame speech for his dad. It was him and Dustin up there doing the intro for Dusty. And that was the first time I really heard Cody speak. And he had tremendous speaking ability even back then. And then they did that one angle, which, if I remember correctly, I think it was at the beginning of when they were doing the Raw guest host. Dusty Rhodes may have been the second ever Raw guest host. And he turned heel and was kind of not aligning necessarily, but... You know, he was making things easier, I think, for Legacy, and I forgot the main event that he made. But anyway, at the end of the show, Orton laid him out with an RKO. And Raw that night faded out with a shot of Cody Rhodes in the corner, not cowering, but kind of seething. Like, you wanted Cody to go rip Randy Orton's head off in the worst way, but he wouldn't do it. I think Orton was eyeballing him from the opposite side of the ring, and the entire crowd was chanting Cody's name. I mean, the entire crowd was into it. They wanted so badly for Cody Rhodes to go beat the hell out of Randy Orton. And I saw something that night that told me, okay, this guy could really get over Cody Rhodes, not Ted DiBiase could be the next big star. And of course, I mean, it's debatable what level of success Cody has had. DiBiase certainly has fallen off the face of the earth. So yeah, Cody definitely had more success than he did. And he's been the Intercontinental Champion and all that. But really, how much success has Cody Rhodes had? How far up the food chain has Cody Rhodes moved in the years since then? I would argue not very far at all. So, what they're waiting for, I have no idea. They really need to get off their ass and do something with him. And I'm hopeful that now they're finally going to do something. And hopefully they'll start with having him shave that shit off his face. Mark Henry. They had a great video package for him early in the show. They had clips from the beginning of his career all the way through the modern day. Then Henry came out for a promo that went a long way towards getting me to cheer for him at the pay-per-view. I was going to cheer for him at the pay-per-view anyway, but I'm not sure that was the intended effect here. He came out and was almost like the hero. He talked about backstage politics and having to go through a lot of crap, quite literally, actually. There's an infamous story as told by X-Pac of someone taking a shit in Henry's meatball sandwich not long after he came into the company, and he actually ate the damn thing. So the promo was actually really good in spite of the crowd chanting what at him the entire way through. Another reason to hate the people in Sioux Falls, wherever the hell they were, Sioux Falls, Iowa. Mental midgets these people are. If you find yourself chanting what for no real reason and nearly ruining what was otherwise a really good promo, you are a mental midget. They even threw Henry off his train of thought a couple of times, but he rebounded okay. People were blaming Steve Austin on Twitter, and it's funny, in response to one person, Austin actually tweeted back, I had no idea that would happen. Like, he had no idea this monster that he would create. But to him, I say, it's okay. It's okay, Steve. How could he know that brain damage was so prevalent among wrestling fans? Who knew? They built up the main event all night as being something historic. A champion versus champion match between John Cena and Alberto Del Rio. I don't know what was so historic about it. I mean, we've seen champion versus champion matches on Raw before. It's not like they've ever tried to really make it something special. They did Miz versus Edge when both were champion, and the people could not have cared less. They did Punk versus Bryan on Raw when both of them were champion, but for some reason, we were told this was historic. What I did like was, and I thought it was a nice touch, were the videos commemorating some of the great champions from over the years. We had videos for Buddy Rogers, Lou Thesz, who had absolutely nothing to do with their version of the world title, which came out of a briefcase and was given to Triple H just so he could call himself champion. But it is nice of them to recognize Lou Thesz. Bruno Sammartino, Harley Race, Bob Backlund, Dusty Rhodes, Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, Steve Austin, Sting. So now Hulk Hogan and Sting can say they were both on Raw and Impact in the same week. Triple H and Booker T were the other two as well. No Rock, which was kind of surprising. Obviously, they couldn't fit everybody in. They only had so much time. The real interesting one was Sting. They certainly did not have to put him in there. That was a conscious decision on their part. Makes me wonder if that's not a subtle show of respect on their part with the expectation of something in return. Sting's done some interviews recently where he makes no bones about the fact that he would love to have a WrestleMania match with Undertaker. I think that ship has sailed. I think 2011 was the time to do it, and instead Sting re-signed with TNA. He had some discussions with WWE, but it never really got very far. And you know what? Even if he didn't re-sign with TNA, I mean, they could have found a role maybe for him at WrestleMania, but I don't think it would have been against Undertaker anyway, because that was Triple H's match. And there's no way that Triple H was going to step aside and let Sting come into the company and have his match. So I don't think there was ever any realistic shot of that happening. I could see WWE offering Sting a Lesnar or RVD-type deal just to get him away from TNA. Maybe get a few marquee matches out of him and put him in the Hall of Fame. Sell some DVDs. They had to put Hogan in the video on Raw because it would have been ridiculous not to acknowledge him. Would have been petty for them to leave him out. But Sting, they didn't have to put him in there. And my opinion, I think all of these Sting to WWE rumors that we've been seeing, the rumors about him sending feelers to WWE, WWE thinking they've got him in the bag, you know, when his contract is up. I think it's all much ado about nothing. He's not going to WWE. They could make a play for him, but it ain't happening. He's 54 years old. TNA has been very good to Sting. He's been loyal to them. It's not happening. Don't get your hopes up. Anyway, Cena Del Rio had a good match. Shitty finish, but a good match. Cena had Del Rio in the STF. Mark Henry walked down to the ring, distracted Cena. Del Rio went for the arm breaker. This brought down Dolph Ziggler, who distracted Del Rio. Cena hoisted him up. AA pinned the world champion. So just in case there was any doubt where the world title is in the pecking order in this company, you know, they have matches all the time with, like, top stars. They don't want to beat either one of them, so there'll be, like, a non-finish or a schmoz, a DQ or whatever. Not here. Cena beats Del Rio clean, 1-2-3. After the match, Henry brought the belt into the ring. He dropped it on the mat, and it was funny. Every time Cena would go to pick it up, would make a step towards the championship, Henry would kind of fake him out like he was going to attack, and Cena would back off. Henry was great here. I'd be shocked if we didn't get Cena Ziggler against Henry Del Rio as our TV main event this week on Raw. And finally, the Wyatt family is on their way. At long last, next week, they arrive. A lot of you seem to think that this job performance evaluation the McMahons are going to give Vicky and Brad Maddox on Raw this Monday may be where the Wyatts rear their head. I'll tell you what, it would put them squarely in the middle of one of the main storylines on Raw right now if they did it, so I'd be okay with that. Especially if they lay out the McMahons. The Shield pushed out last time. They let the McMahons walk away without harming a hair on their head. The Wyatts don't strike me as being the kind of folks to have much in the way of remorse, so maybe they can do what the Shield failed to do. Unless they're going to just have a normal debut, you know, with a long promo in the ring, or just give him a squash match against somebody like Zack Ryder. Where else do they really fit, if you think about it, other than the McMahon segment on Raw this Monday? It's the go-home show. They've got 6 days left before a pay-per-view that they're not wrestling on. It doesn't really make any sense to get them involved in any of the other existing programs. So the McMahon thing would seem to make the most sense. But it's good. It's a good thing the Wyatts are on their way, and that brings us to the bad on this show. The opening segment sucked. I hate when they do the deal where everybody in the multi-man match has to come out one by one to state their case about why they think they're going to win. You had Sheamus mocking Daniel Bryan for beating him in 18 seconds at WrestleMania. He also called him a troll, which is the word I used on the Sound Off last week to describe how they were portraying Bryan on TV. And now they just went and used the word themselves on television, which is just great. That's just what he needs right now. Randy Orton came out. He said that he was starving. They've got catering backstage. I don't know why he was so hungry. Everyone but RVD was out there at the end, and Orton ended up leaving Kane laying with an RKO, which led to a match later in the show between the two with Daniel Bryan as the guest referee. On commentary, Jerry Lawler was babbling about how Kane just had to beat Randy Orton. It was so important to Kane that he get that win over Randy Orton, you know, because Daniel Bryan was able to beat Randy Orton on Raw the week before, but then Kane went and lost to Orton on SmackDown. Kane just had to know that he could beat Orton. And I'm listening to this, and I'm just saying to myself, hello? Kane beat Randy Orton at WrestleMania last year. I should know. I was there. But I guess it's more important for Kane to beat him in some random TV match that we'll all forget 2 weeks from now. The match itself was nothing special. They did a false finish where Bryan DQ'd Orton for shoving him, giving Kane the victory. Kane was not pleased with that. He did not want to win that way, so he had Bryan restart the match. Orton was setting up for an RKO on Kane when Bryan stepped in the way, and with the distraction, Kane was able to get off a big boot to Orton's face, made the cover, and Daniel Bryan made a fast count, giving Kane his second win of the night. And Kane was still not thrilled. He grabbed Daniel Bryan by the throat, much to the delight of the crowd in Sioux City, by the way, one of the few times these people reacted all night. So maybe they have changed their minds, and they're going to turn Daniel Bryan heel, because if they're not, this makes absolutely no sense to me. Kane let him go, the crowd booed, and then Orton laid out Bryan with an RKO to end the segment. I did not like this at all. Fandango is back. He was out there for a match against Sheamus. Walkout finish, which I am sick to death of. Absolutely terrible. Why even bother with the match if you're just going to have the dude walk out? I could almost live with it if you have a heel, like a chicken shit heel. Like Shawn Michaels used to do that all the time when he was the Intercontinental Champion back in 93. And it was frustrating as a fan, but, you know, as a heel, you do it to get heat. You can't beat the guy, so you say, fuck it, I'm going to take my belt and walk out, and the people boo. The problem is, I feel like they do this finish every freaking week. Enough already with the walkouts. It's such a cop-out finish. And again, this match, I don't even know what sense this made, because Fandango and Sheamus are not even in the same Money in the Bank match, so I don't know why they were in the ring together in the first place. Ryback against The Miz. Chris Jericho is on commentary. That was about the only good thing about this. He was trying to tell the story of Ryback suddenly having doubts about himself in the ring. Chris Jericho was doing some storytelling for us. He called him Cryback. Ryback dominated for a while. Miz fought back. He went after Ryback's knee. And in the end, Ryback is in the corner when suddenly he can take no more of Miz's onslaught, and he quits. This was amazing. I thought for sure when Ryback confronted Miz after the match, he was going to blindside him and beat his ass and show that he really wasn't hurt. He just was being a heel. But he didn't do anything. He kind of limped over. He and Miz were staring at each other. And Chris Jericho got in the ring. He spun Ryback around. And he gave him a code breaker. And he left him laying. And that's how the segment ended. I thought for sure the next day we were going to find out that he was suspended for 30 days for a wellness violation. As it turned out, it was actually Ricardo who got suspended. I have to think there's more to this story that we're going to find out as the weeks go on as far as what the hell they're doing with Ryback. I assume this is Cryback's new gimmick. And what a gimmick it is. You know, it really doesn't matter. Anyway, I guess they killed him dead after all those pay-per-view losses when he beats Jericho at Money in the Bank. It's not going to help Ryback. It's just going to devalue Jericho that much more to lose to a guy who couldn't buy a pay-per-view win to save his life. It's been 1 year this month. I don't know if people realize this or not. 1 year ago this month was the last time Ryback got a pay-per-view win. and it was against two jobbers. The guy is dead. Who cares? May as well just try something different with him. Maybe it'll work. But it won't matter anyway, because he's not going to draw. So, who cares? The Ugly. Caitlin pinned Alicia Fox after a spear. Diva stopwatch has the time at 1 minute 52 seconds. AJ and Big E came out post-match, and they showed a photoshopped picture of Caitlin's head on some morbidly obese woman's body. This was supposed to be comedy, I guess. I've enjoyed AJ's heel tactics with Caitlin up to this point. I think she's been quite good. This sucked. I don't understand, you know, what is the point of this whole segment? I mean, what was it designed to do? Was it designed to make Caitlin angry? That AJ showed an obviously fake photo of her? Because Caitlin seemed to laugh it off more than be angry about it. I thought she was going to show some real photos of Caitlin from before her wrestling days. You can actually find them on Google. It's Caitlin from her bodybuilding days, pre-boob job. They're not very PG, though, so I suppose that's probably why we didn't see them. But this whole thing was just stupid. I now have less interest in seeing their rematch than I did their first match at Payback. And speaking of the Divas, they had a shitty segment backstage with the Bellas, the Funkadactyls, Natalya, and the two new Divas that are debuting on that Total Divas reality show, Eva Marie and JoJo Offerman. They shot this like a reality show. They had three different camera angles they kept alternating between. This sucked. Absolutely none of this is rooted in reality. And that's a problem I have with all reality TV shows. I'm not just going to, you know, blast WWE or the E! Network. It's a problem with all reality TV. None of them are real. Why the fuck is it called reality TV? They're all fake. Every last one of those shows are fake. Hogan Knows Best was fake. Totally scripted. Celebrity Wife Swap is fake. I saw the episode with Ric Flair and Roddy Piper last week, and it was hilarious. Very entertaining. Not reality television. Completely fake. And that's fine, as long as you know that going in. But then just come up with a different name for it. How about Warped Reality? Warped Reality makes more sense. That's what it should be called. And as for what happened in this segment, they all argued, I really was only half paying attention. I was flipping between that and a New York Mets game that went 13 innings. Friggin' game lasted over 5 hours. And miraculously, they won. I say miraculous, you see, because the Mets usually find a way to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. That's their MO. I think they left something like 17 men on base in the game, and somehow they won. And actually, the best part of that game was Gary Cohen, who is the play-by-play guy for the Mets. He goes, the biggest mosquito I've ever seen in my life just flew into the booth. He is now deceased. And Keith Hernandez, who is one of the all-time great Mets players and now is a color commentator, he just flips out. He could not believe that Gary killed this mosquito. Keith is awesome because the later the game gets, especially if it goes extra innings, he gets really restless. Like, he just can't wait for it to end. He'll start sighing through his microphone, all that kind of stuff, talking about what he's going to do after the game's over. He starts to entertain himself, kind of like me watching Raw this week. But for as awful as the Mets are, they have the single greatest announce booth in all of baseball. Seriously, for those of you who aren't baseball fans, Gary, Keith, and Ron Darling, another player who does color analysis for them, they are the absolute best. Cole King and JBL work well together, but not well enough where they actually can help save shitty shows like the one we got this week. These three guys, if you're having a boring game, a long game, they could save the entire thing. That's how good they are. Cole King and JBL, maybe they can work to be as good as these three are. So anyway, yeah, this segment sucked, and I was only half paying attention to it. I can only imagine how much worse the other dialogue was beyond what I heard. So that was Raw from Monday night. Not a great show. A lot more bad this week than last week. SmackDown, from what I saw, I'm not done watching SmackDown, actually. I've only seen bits and pieces. I did see the Randy Orton-Christian match. When I found out that Randy Orton and Christian were having a match, I knew I was at least watching that match, if nothing else, and they did not disappoint. They had a good match. Not the best match I've seen between the two of them, but it's the first one I've seen between them probably in well over a year. And find it if you can. Watch it. Christian, though, boy, Christian cannot buy a win over Randy Orton. It just seems very lopsided. If you take all the Randy Orton-Christian matches there have ever been, you can easily count on one hand the number of times Christian has won and still have plenty of fingers left over. But they have great chemistry. They are good in the ring, so I definitely enjoyed their match on Friday night. Switch over here to NXT. I caught this week's episode, and I thought it was actually much better than last week. Last week's show I just thought largely was boring. This week was an improvement over that. We had Bo Dallas backstage with Renee Young to open the show with a promo, which is not necessarily something to look forward to. But he was interrupted pretty quickly by Antonio Cesaro, who Bo referred to as the most irrelevant United States champion in history. And that's a shoot right there. Find me another more worthless U.S. champion than Antonio Cesaro turned out to be. Anyway, this set up our main event for later in the show, Cesaro versus Dallas for the NXT Championship. Paige defeated Alicia Fox to advance to the finals of the NXT Women's Title Tournament. Not a bad match at all by WWE Diva standards. Paige has this move she calls the Paige Turner. She won with that move, so she is in the finals. Conor O'Brien beat Andy Baker in a squash. I like Conor O'Brien's, if you ever watch him, and I only noticed it really this week, he has what I would call like this nonstop offense, where he'll hit moves in rapid-fire succession. Boom, boom, boom. He doesn't give his opponent any time to breathe. I like that. He's all action, no nonsense. His matches are over pretty quickly. He was escorted to the ring on this show by Rick Victor. So Rick Victor apparently will be his new partner in the Ascension. I had one person email me suggesting that perhaps Sami Callihan, who has signed a developmental deal with WWE and has kind of a goth-type gimmick, perhaps they would put Sami Callihan with Conor O'Brien as his new partner in the Ascension, but apparently not. Apparently it will be Rick Victor. They're plugging in there. They didn't say that. I'm just assuming that's the case since he was with him at ringside. Corey Graves and Adrian Neville were backstage with Renee Young. There was no sign of Cassius Ohno on this show. Maybe I missed it if they said he was injured. I don't really know why he wasn't there. I don't know if that's good or bad for him. Neville made a plea in this promo for William Regal to join them in taking out the Wyatt family. And later in the show, Regal accepted the invitation. So we've got ourselves a six-man tag team main event next week. The Wyatt family against Adrian Neville, Corey Graves, and William Regal. And that right there is a main event that I am looking forward to. Xavier Woods, who may be my new favorite wrestler on NXT, he beat one half of Sylvester Lefort's boring tag team, Scott Dawson. Woods also has the best entrance in all of NXT. He's right there with Emma. Good match for the 4 minutes it lasted, until it was morphin' time for Woods. He hit his honor roll clothesline, which is basically just a forward roll into a flying clothesline, and Gail Kim's eat defeat, which he calls lost in the woods, got the pin. You know, Xavier Woods, he's just fun. He's fun to watch. You know, the music, the character, everything about it just screams fun. It screams mid-card, but it screams fun. And it helps that he's also a pretty damn good wrestler. On the other side, we have Mason Ryan, who is not a very good wrestler. He pinned Enzo Amore in literally all of 10 seconds. Amore was escorted to the ring by Colin Cassidy, this 7-foot-tall, you know, long-haired dude. And he cut a promo on Mason Ryan before the match. He speaks with this ridiculously thick New Jersey accent. He called Ryan soft. He's soft, you see. And when he climbed into the ring, Ryan clocked him in the face and pinned him. So then Amore says that Ryan got lucky. No way you could do it twice, he says. He sends Cassidy in to take care of business, and the big man gets squashed by Mason Ryan in about 30 seconds. And, you know, I've been watching this show now for 6 weeks, and I still can't tell you if Mason Ryan is any better in the ring than the last time most of you probably saw him on TV, because his matches all end in a minute or less. So given that, my guess is that nothing much has changed. He still is not that good. Because if he was any good, they would just trust him in longer matches. And by longer matches, I mean like 3 minutes. Or 4 minutes instead of one. The main event on this show was really good. Yeah, it's worth 10 minutes of your time if you could find it. I'm sure it must be somewhere online. If you don't have Hulu Plus, check Daily Motion or some of those sites. Bo Dallas and Antonio Cesaro for the NXT Championship. And there was a great exchange. And I talked about this once before. This week, we had the announced team of William Regal and Tony Dawson. Tony Dawson was the play-by-play guy. Tony Dawson is no good. Tony Dawson used to be JBL and Cole's kind of sidekick they would bully around. on their JBL and Cole radio show. I think he also appears on their YouTube show as well. He may still be on the YouTube show. I think on their radio show, he's been replaced by Renee Young. He really is not good at all. And he can be quite annoying at times, including to William Regal. And maybe it's part of their shtick, but I still find it very entertaining, this exchange. At one point, Tony Dawson goes, "What do you think it would mean for Antonio Cesaro to be champion?" And without skipping a beat, William Regal just says, "Sometimes you ask me really stupid questions, Tony. What do you think it's going to mean? It means he'll be champion." So, I enjoy it whenever William Regal takes the time to make fun of Tony Dawson. I wish we all could make fun of Tony Dawson. Just a couple of notes here from this match. Antonio Cesaro was cheered like a babyface. Big cheers for Cesaro when he came out. Major heat for Bo Dallas. He is hated by these people. In fact, during the match, we had a couple of instances where the crowd in unison started a loud "We the People" chant, because Cesaro is sticking with his "We the People" gimmick even on NXT now. So they're all chanting "We the People." They're cheering for him whenever he's on offense. We had dueling chants for Bo Dallas, one half of the crowd chanting "Let's go, Bo," the other half chanting "No more Bo." He is the John Cena of NXT, is Bo Dallas. And later on, we had Cesaro had Bo Dallas trapped in a reverse chin lock. See, Cesaro is I love watching Cesaro because he could take a move like a chin lock. And look, a chin lock is not an exciting maneuver. I used to make fun of Randy Orton. He was known for the chin lock, right? The infamous Randy Orton chin lock. There he goes. A chin lock is a boring move no matter who puts it on, including Antonio Cesaro. But at least when Cesaro puts it on, he makes the effort to cinch it in and make it look painful. And William Regal on commentary was going on about this, how he's saying, "Oh, watch him. Watch Cesaro. Look what he does." And I love how Regal made reference to the match he had with Cesaro on Raw a few weeks ago. Remember, all of a sudden, William Regal popped up on Raw and he did like a 2-minute squash to Antonio Cesaro. He was referring to that match and saying, "Look, I know what I'm talking about. I've been caught in that move before. It looks like a basic chin lock, but it's not. You can't breathe. He tightens up on it." This felt like a real competitive match here, not some of the shit that you would see on Raw Monday night where they're only half paying attention and they're busy bickering with one another. So he's got Bo Dallas in a reverse chin lock, and the entire crowd is chanting "tap." They want Bo Dallas to tap out to this chin lock. It was great. Leo Kruger was out there. About midway through the match, Leo Kruger came out. He was observing the match from the outside. And for the finish, he jumped up on the apron. He tried to grab Bo Dallas basically from behind, and instead, when Cesaro came running in, Bo ducked out of the way, and Cesaro nailed Kruger. He ran into him, knocked him off the apron. So when Cesaro turns around, he gets caught for a belly-to-belly suplex for the pin, so Bo Dallas retains the title. Kruger comes back in the ring. He beats down Bo Dallas after the match. Then Antonio Cesaro lands a European uppercut on Leo Kruger, knocks him out of the way. He wants to beat up Bo Dallas some more, so now Dallas is basically, he ends up fighting both guys at the same time. And people are very happy with this. They are more than happy to see Bo Dallas double-teamed and beaten down by these two men. Sami Zayn comes out to make the save. He gets a bunch of ole ole chants. He disposes of the bad guys and shakes hands with Bo Dallas as the show ends. So that was NXT. Very, very good main event. They've set up a great main event for next week. And the Bo Dallas situation is very interesting. There are people who absolutely hate Bo Dallas. I had a person on Twitter say he's got no talent at all, which is laughable to me because, as I said to this person, if Bo Dallas really had no talent, he wouldn't be on the roster, let alone the NXT champion. He has to have some talent. Okay, he even got called up to the main roster for a month when they did the whole thing with him and Wade Barrett. Bo Dallas is not terrible. What's terrible about him is this cheesy babyface persona. But now that it looks like they're turning him heel, which I hope that's the plan, if they're doing it, they're doing the slow burn, okay? Ultimately, I would figure that Bo Dallas will go heel. If not, then this is John Cena all over again. And that's the problem I have with this. You've got John Cena 2.0 now brewing in NXT. And it's one thing if they don't want to turn John Cena heel. I can understand their reasons why they wouldn't want to. But there's no reason not to turn Bo Dallas heel. And what a heel he would be. The people would hate him. The people would pay money to see this guy have his ass kicked. Although I don't think the people at Full Sail pay money for their tickets, but that's beside the point. So hopefully that's the direction they're going in, because otherwise, like I said, it's John Cena all over again. You got the dueling chants, they hate him, he's, you know, just the cheesiest babyface you'll ever see in your life. And that works if the end game here is for him to be hated, not for him to be loved, which I don't know anybody that loves Bo Dallas. Let's switch over to TNA here. Got a lot of TNA stuff to cover here this week, and there was some big TNA news. They released a whole bunch of people. Crimson, Joey Ryan, Christian York, and Taylor Hendricks are no longer with TNA. Although Taylor Hendricks on her Twitter claimed that it was her decision to leave, I think what happened with her is she may have been offered a new contract and just decided against it. You know, maybe they weren't paying her enough, I don't know. But Taylor Hendricks, Christian York, Joey Ryan, who actually lost the gut check, but they ended up doing an angle with Joey Ryan that resulted in him getting a contract in TNA, all of them were connected to the gut check. That's the common thread there. Crimson was not. Crimson was surprising, though, because we just saw Crimson on television, what was it, 2 weeks ago? That he was on TV in that match against Joseph Park? That Christian was off television, Crimson, I should say, for over a year. So they bring him back, they put him on television, he loses to Joe Park, and then they get rid of him. Well, why bring him back to television in the first place? And what was so bad about the guy that you wanted to cut him? I thought the whole point was to send these guys down to OVW so they can get some training and some seasoning and learn from the vets down there and Danny Davis and Rip Rogers and all these other people. And then when they're ready, you bring him back up. He had the size, he had the look. But I just can't get past this whole idea that they actually... He was gone for a year. They had to have some sense that he was going to get let go. And they brought him back to TV first. It doesn't make any sense. Anyway, it's believed that all of these cuts were due to budget cuts. TNA has let a whole bunch of people behind the scenes go recently. A lot of their marketing and PR people have been cut or have left. They just had another one of their PR people, Lindsay Bynum, who left the company, I guess, to pursue other opportunities. So people are either jumping off the ship or they're being cut, whatever the reasons are. There's a lot of people leaving TNA. But these in particular were said to be because of budget cuts. You know, because, hey, Rampage Jackson ain't going to pay for himself. Somebody's going to pay the price when you bring in a big free agent like Rampage Jackson. So between that and they've got the added expense of taking Impact on the road, I'm not sure how much of that, if any, Spike TV is footing the bill for. You've got to think that Spike is kicking in something and had something to do with TNA making the decision to finally get out of the Impact zone, which was long overdue. I'm happy TNA did that. I don't want the company to go out of business because of it. And I don't know what they're going to do because, you know, they had a lease with Universal that I guess they let expire. I don't know if there's somebody else now that's using that space or if it's still open, so I don't even know if they can go back to the Impact Zone. I think as far as I'm aware, they're done. They've cut ties with the Impact Zone, so I don't even know that they could go back right away if they wanted to. So they've got some issues going on right now. You know, PW Torch first broke the story that TNA has been about 1 month behind on payroll, which has affected everybody's pay on the roster. I seriously doubt that it's affected Hulk Hogan or Sting's pay, but who knows? I mean, maybe it has. Maybe that's why these rumors popped up about Sting sending feelers to WWE. And PW Insider claimed that one unidentified TNA talent said that other wrestlers are, in some cases, as much as 2 months behind on pay. I mean, when I heard that, the first thing I thought of was ECW. You heard all the stories about the old ECW, especially towards the end. People not getting paid at all. There are still people to this day. I mean, they joke about it, but it's true. I mean, Paul Heyman, there's some guys that he never paid. And that's a really shitty thing, too, because if there's guys that Paul Heyman owed money to, and Paul Heyman jumped over to WWE and was probably making pretty good money, as I'm sure he is today, you know, to just think like, oh, well, you know, so much time has gone by that, you know, these guys don't have to get paid. I mean, I wonder if that weighs on Heyman's conscience. My guess is it doesn't. My guess is it probably doesn't, but that's still a pretty shitty thing. So yeah, this when I read that, this had ECW written all over it. And it makes you wonder. It makes you wonder about the future of TNA. You would think things are not that bad that they're going to go out of business, but when people are a month or two behind on pay and people are jumping ship, it's not a good sign. And there's another report that claims that TNA's working relationship with OVW, Ohio Valley Wrestling, which has sort of become their de facto developmental territory, you know, that's where they've been sending most of these gut check people that we never see on TV, that relationship is not exactly healthy right now. And so that, too, could also be related to money issues. You know, Doug Williams was released by TNA a few weeks ago, and he did an interview after his release and said that TNA has almost completely stopped funding OVW. And they've just been sending a bunch of undercard wrestlers there and really not much more than that. I mean, it's what bit WWE on the ass for so many years when it came to developmental. They were hardly pumping any money into it, and you had a lot of lean years with very few stars made. Only recently under Triple H has that really started to change. And I know that WWE has a lot more money than TNA does to invest in developmental. I get that. But that's your future right there. You know, more indie guys are being snatched up by WWE. And once they open this new performance center down in Florida this week, they're going to have room to hire even more talent. So between that and the fact that there are only so many former WWE guys that TNA can sign, what's their future going to look like if they don't invest in it? But to go back to this gut check thing, it begs the question, is gut check a failed experiment? I would say it was doomed from the start. If their idea was to give people contracts, okay, to parade them on television, and to sign them to a TNA contract, and then just send them away, and never refer back to them, it's like they're just completely forgotten. There's a flaw in that concept right there. Because I thought the gut check concept was a good one. I actually was kind of looking forward to seeing what would come of it. Open fight night, I hate. I just do not like the open fight night concept. But gut check, I wanted to give gut check a chance. And now that we see all these gut check guys that are being cut from TNA, they're no longer there. Alex Silva, who I think was the first gut check winner, I believe he also was let go recently. Gut check has been an utter and complete failure. An absolute waste of time. No new stars have been made. And the guys that they thought had potential, that they sent to OVW to get better and to get further training, they got rid of. So what's the point of gut check? It just seems like a colossal waste of time. Taz took to Twitter on Wednesday, just to follow up on an item I mentioned last week. He announced that he has indeed signed a new contract to stay with TNA. So that ends the speculation about him going back to WWE. Taz is happy where he is. Obviously, he's not one of the people behind a month or two on his pay, and so he'll be staying put in the announce booth with Mike Tenay. I attended the TNA baseball event in Brooklyn at MCU Park on Friday. This is the fourth year in a row they've done this show. It's become one of the biggest shows all year that TNA does, and this is my fourth time attending. I'm terrible at guessing what the attendance was. I'll find out during the week exactly how many people were there. If I had a guess, and again, I'm terrible at this, but I would say probably somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000. It took a while, but the seats did fill up nicely. The crowds dwindle a little bit more each year. I think unless, you know, if they come back again next year, I think unless they bring some sort of gimmick, like maybe bring the steel cage, have a cage match, or if they spring the money to sign, you know, Hulk Hogan for the event, I think to get Hogan for an event like this, you've got to pay like an extra 10 grand or something ridiculous like that, which I can tell you those folks are not willing to do because that's a ridiculous amount of money. We had Sting, you know, the year before, which was nice. At least I can say that I finally saw Sting wrestle live, which I never had before. So that was a nice attraction. They didn't have anything like that this year. But it was a good card, you know, just a fun way to spend Friday night. It's always a risk doing these outdoor shows. We got great weather, though. We really lucked out. The weather in New York has been absolute shit. It's been raining every day. It's like Florida. You know, you'll have a rainstorm, a thunderstorm that just pops up out of nowhere, and then 15 minutes later it disappears. But we actually lucked out. We had good weather. We had Eric Young beating Jesse Godders in the opening match. And also, I have to say this. These events are not quite the same without Don West. I miss that. I miss Don West running around, all red-faced, looking like he was about to keel over from a heart attack, pimping out his brown bag merchandise specials. He was so awesome. You know, they've got that guy Jimmy J now. Jimmy J was actually there last year because Don had already left. It's not the same. It's not the same without Don West. Mickie James beat Velvet Sky to retain her Knockouts title. Mickie James had Peter Rosenberg Velvet Sky had Peter Rosenberg in her corner. Peter Rosenberg is that radio DJ. He's done some tremendous interviews. He did the interview recently with Bully Ray. He did a great sit-down 20-minute interview that's up on YouTube with Big Show many months ago. He's very good at that. He's a hardcore wrestling fan and a popular DJ at the radio station, Hot 97. But he was booed by the crowd here. He was a heel all the way to the people in Brooklyn. They did not like Peter Rosenberg. They were actually hoping that he would get his ass kicked by Mickey James, and unfortunately that never happened. Joseph Park made his Impact Wrestling debut in Brooklyn against D-Von of Aces and Eights. I got to give D-Von credit. D-Von actually busted out a spin-a-rooney in this match, which I've never seen D-Von do before, but there it was. He did a spin-a-rooney for all of us. And in the end, he beat Joe Park, who I did not get a chance to meet. I was very disappointed. AJ Styles, Samoa Joe, and Bobby Roode had a three-way match, which you would think, boy, this could be a show stealer. And it was actually very good, but the problem is it literally lasted all of 4, maybe 5 minutes. They always do that with these matches. They shortchange these matches. Why they couldn't give this one, let's say, 10 minutes, I have no idea. But it was really good for the time it lasted. Joe got the win. He made Bobby Roode tap out in the end, so Samoa Joe gets the win. Jeff Hardy and Austin Aries had a Bound for Glory series match that Jeff Hardy won by pinfall, so he gets the points in the BFG series. And the one thing I realized, if I didn't already know this, when Jeff Hardy came out, he is the most popular performer, at least on this night. Again, maybe Sting gets more cheers and Hogan does, but Jeff Hardy is the most popular in-ring performer that TNA has. That's been the case, I think, for a while. It's still the case. He came out, he got a bigger reaction up to this point than anybody else did on the entire show. And Jeff Hardy's great. You know, he goes around, he smacks hands with all the fans at ringside. He's very, you know, personable and interactive with the fans. He was great. And good match. Beat Austin Aries, got the points. One thing that TNA has to work on, I'm not sure if they do this at the other Base Brawl events, and I know why they do it. They want people to buy their shit, basically, at the concessions. They have Earl Hebner and Dave Hebner go sell their Damn Right I Did It t-shirts and all that up on the concourse. They had a 40-minute intermission. I mean, there's no justification for any sporting event having a 40-minute intermission. I mean, give me a friggin' break. So they got to cut down on that. At least cut it in half. Even Ring of Honor, when I go to Ring of Honor shows and they have an intermission, you know, the ROH intermission is like 20 minutes. Yeah, I could live with that. They had people sitting around for 40 minutes just waiting for the show to start back up again. That's ridiculous. James Storm and Gunner beat Bad Influence, Chris Daniels and Frankie Kazarian, to retain their tag team titles. And Bad Influence is great. Christopher Daniels is just beyond awesome. The way he interacts with the crowd, he almost came to blows with some kid in the front row. He's flipping people off, you know, gyrating at them, jaw-jacking the whole time. Just, you know, some guys ignore the crowd. Daniels embraces it. He loves it. And he feeds off them. He's so freaking awesome. Storm and Gunner win. The main event was Bully Ray defending the heavyweight championship against Kurt Angle. Good match. I've seen Kurt Angle have better matches. Bully Ray is great in his role, but Bully Ray was never a great wrestler, per se. He's not a master technician. So when somebody like a brawler like Bully Ray is in there with Kurt Angle, you're not going to necessarily get a great match. And it was, you know, a cheap finish. I don't think anybody expected the outcome to be any different. Bully used a chain, hit Kurt Angle with it when the referee wasn't looking. Brian Hebner has got to be the worst damn referee in the entire world because, first of all, he and Earl were the only referees on the entire show. So, father and son, they're the only ones they bring out for these events. And as bad as Earl Hebner can be, missing things, I mean, every referee is like that, but Brian Hebner, it seems like, he is the biggest goofball referee you'll ever see. He misses everything. Everything that happens. He's in the wrong spot. He misses it. Oh, what happened? You know, he's got to be the worst. And Bully got the pin on Kurt Angle, retained the championship. Kurt sent everybody home happy by giving Bully a Olympic slam after the match. And then TNA does this thing that's very smart, and WWE can't do it because they have a lot more people than TNA does at their shows, but it's very smart. They did this deal, which they always do, where Kurt Angle, in this case, stays in the ring, and they invite fans to come wait in line. They can come into the ring, and they can pose for a photo with Kurt Angle for $20. And this time, they put a little bit of a different twist on it, which they haven't done before, in that you could come get a picture with Kurt Angle for $20 and just bring your whole group. So it didn't matter if you were there with 5 people, 2 people, 15 people. You pay one price, $20, to get your photo taken in the ring with Kurt Angle. And they had a line wrapped around the stadium for this thing. Very, very smart, and I'm sure that's how TNA is making a lot of their money when it comes to events like this. Very smart on their part. They made a lot of money doing that on this night. So it was a fun show. Much like Impact on Thursday night was a fun show. This Impact was taped the previous weekend from Las Vegas. Remember last week how I said they got me with the Austin Aries as Suicide Swerve? I was all happy to see them doing something with Aries finally again in main events. Well, that lasted all of 1 week, but I can't complain too much because we got one hell of a main event on this show. Hulk Hogan announced at the beginning that because of the scam that Austin Aries perpetrated on all of us, he would have to defend his newly won X Division title against both Chris Sabin and Suicide, who is no longer Suicide. He's now called Manic. Now, two things on this. First of all, Suicide was a stupid name to begin with. The guy got over, and you've got wrestling fans chanting Suicide on television. That's not too bright. So they changed it, finally. Why the long wait? No idea. The guy's been Suicide for years now, and now you change his name? Did somebody just now realize that calling someone Suicide is probably a bad idea? Second, I find it odd that they reveal on television last week that TJ Perkins, who actually has a good look to him, is the man behind the Suicide mask, and yet the very next week, he's back under the mask. You can't do that. You already revealed who the guy is. He's not Kane. You can't just put him back under the mask and expect us to forget about what happened the week before. When a luchador in Mexico is unmasked, which is a big deal down there, do they end up back wearing their mask again? I mean, maybe that's common practice. Maybe they do. I'm not aware of it. But I don't think they do. And don't tell me Rey Mysterio, because that was different. That was a case of WWE trying to fix one of WCW's many fuck-ups when they took Rey's mask off. AJ Styles earned 10 points in the Bound for Glory series by making Frankie Kazarian tap out to the Calf Killer. We learned that the Gail Kim vs. Taryn Terrell ladder match takes place on Impact next week. I cannot wait for that one. And I'm not being facetious at all when I say that. I actually really am looking forward to a knockouts match. We saw Bruce Pritchard, Al Snow, and Danny Davis from OVW backstage deliberating over the two gut check schmucks from last week's show. After what happened this week, how can anyone take any of this gut check stuff seriously, is my question. They decided to cut the Big O first, so he can head back to Long Island to hang out with his buddy Zack. Now he knows how Zack Ryder must feel like each week. The Big O never even made it to the ring for the final evaluation. He was stuck backstage. Later on in the ring, the judges brought out Ryan from Tough Enough. Al Snow voted no. Danny Davis said he was going to vote no, but said that he was impressed by the crowd's booing, not causing him to stumble during his promo. So he changed his vote to a yes. Boy, doesn't take much to impress people in the wrestling business these days, does it? Pritchard then dragged things out like he normally does for a dramatic effect. He finally said no, so Ryan Howe gets no contract. And to that I say good, because I don't think either one of them deserved a contract based on that match they had last week. It's not like he wouldn't be released from his contract within 6 months anyway, even if they did vote yes. Hernandez pinned Jay Bradley after the pounce to earn 7 points in the BFG series. Chavo Guerrero was out there in the corner of Hernandez. He tripped up Bradley, which caused the distraction, allowed Hernandez to win, which we were told Hernandez did not see. So I had figured Chavo was going heel because of the way he's been acting of late. He's just so obnoxiously over the top, you know, almost like Hernandez is Rocky and Chavo is playing the role of Mickey, only less Caucasian. Sting, Kurt Angle, and Samoa Joe, all in suits, came out for a promo. Joe looks good in a suit. Actually is a slimming look for him. He should wrestle in that suit. After telling us that the main event mafia consists of all former world champions, they proceeded to introduce Magnus as their fourth member. Now, don't get me wrong, I like the idea of Magnus in the main event mafia because they really put him over like a big star here, and I think Magnus looks the part. TNA is finally starting to push this guy up the card, but he'll never be as big of a star as I think he could be unless he goes to WWE. But again, I like this. He felt like a bigger deal just by being in the ring with Sting and Kurt Angle, and he's a great talker too. I think the sky's the limit for Magnus. Sting then challenged Aces and Eights not to a match but to a fight on July 18th on the Destination X edition of Impact. Jeff Hardy beat Joseph Park by DQ in a BFG series match, which means Park is docked 10 points, and I think you get 2 points for the win if your opponent is DQ'd. Joe Park got a shocking amount of offense in this match on Jeff Hardy. He was kicking Hardy's ass before he nailed Joe Park with a whisper in the wind off the top. Park came up with a bloody lip, which caused him to morph into the Incredible Abyss, and he gave the referee a black hole slam before he blacked out. He came back to his senses, realized what just happened. He had this look of grave concern for the referee on his face, and Jeff Hardy did the little finger wag by his head, telling people, "This guy's friggin' nuts." So that was that. Backstage, we had some Aces and Eights drama. Doc pulled Bully Ray aside and said he would be ready for a fight with the Main Event Mafia on July 18th. No problem. He'll be ready. Anderson overheard their conversation. He accused Doc of trying to campaign for the VP position in Aces and Eights, which was formerly held by the excommunicated D'Lo Brown. Anderson said that next week there would be a vote to determine the next VP. I love how in wrestling there is no world that exists outside of Mondays and Thursdays. You ever notice that? Like, why not have the vote in private tomorrow? Why do they have to wait a week? And why is being the VP of Aces and Eights so important? What does the VP do exactly? Bully Ray is the leader, right? He's the president of Aces and Eights. Can the VP overrule Bully? I don't think so. So what's the point of even having a VP? NWO didn't have a VP. It probably should have, with all the people they brought in. The NWO had like 3 times as many members as the Aces and Eights. NWO should have had a VP, a Secretary of State, and a Chief of Staff. Main event was the three-way between Austin Aries, Chris Sabin, and Manic. It was actually very long. Went, I think, over 15 minutes. And turned out to mostly be Austin Aries and Chris Sabin. Aces and Eights had come out, and Doc powerbombed Manic on the floor, so he got taken away. Main Event Mafia later came out to counteract Aces and Eights, make sure they didn't interfere again. I'm not saying these X Division three-ways can't be thrilling and exciting, but what we saw here was, I think, an indictment on their stupid rule that every X Division match has to be a three-way. They're shooting themselves in the foot by doing that, because this turned into a singles match between Aries and Sabin, and it was one of the best TNA matches of the entire year. I can't even do it justice recapping it move for move. You got to find it and just watch it for yourself. Fans were chanting, "This is awesome," which it was. Sabin nailed Aries in the end with his Hail Sabin brainbuster off the top rope and got the pin. So Chris Sabin is once again the X Division champion. He got on the mic and all but told Bully Ray that he was going to take his world title from him. So I take it that Sabin will not be X Division champion for very long if he's cashing in for a world title shot. And I find myself using that word. They use the word cash in. Whenever they talk about this whole thing where the X Division champion can cash in the title to get a shot at what is Bully's belt, can't they use a word other than cash in for this? They kept saying it on Impact, and the term cash in is ripped straight from the Money in the Bank concept. The reason it's used in WWE is because it's money in the bank. So in theory, you're cashing in your briefcase for a title shot. It makes sense. Here, it just sounds silly. You know, maybe they can say that Sabin is trading up for a shot at the world title. So that's just a minor quibble. I'm nitpicking, I know, but a good show. I enjoyed it. And if you watch nothing else from this show, find the main event. It's an awesome match. Some ROH notes here really quickly. Ring of Honor officially announced on Wednesday that for the first time since their first champion was crowned in 2002, the ROH championship is officially vacant. Nigel McGuinness, who is the official matchmaker in Ring of Honor, said the rules state that if the champion cannot defend his title, the ROH championship goes to the number one contender via forfeit. However, he indicated that Michael Elgin, who is the number one contender, basically said, "No, I don't want to win the championship that way." So instead, they will be holding a single elimination tournament beginning on July 27th in Providence, Rhode Island. He said the tournament will conclude at Death Before Dishonor 11. He also stated that Elgin is the first entrant in the tournament, and we have since learned that Brian Kendrick, who competed in the tournament to crown the very first ROH champion, will be the second competitor. Carl Anderson from New Japan Pro Wrestling, Tenzai's former tag team partner, he's the third, along with Paul London and Kevin Steen. Those are the names announced thus far. And the Briscoes, who I talked about last week, Jay Briscoe, of course, no longer ROH champion now. He's been stripped. A lot of rumors about what their future holds. They're no longer under contract to Ring of Honor. Saturday night, the Briscoes with Papa Briscoe, who actually, if the Briscoes ever were to go to WWE or TNA, they got to bring their father with them. Their father is probably a better talker than half the people in wrestling these days. Very entertaining. So hopefully they come as a trio package. But Papa Briscoe is with Jay and Mark apparently at the WWE house show in Ocean City, Maryland on Saturday night. They were in the front row. And that got a lot of people talking. Doesn't necessarily mean anything. They've apparently gotten comp tickets from somebody they know in the company before. So it could just be, hey, maybe they're with their family. They want to check out an out of action. They don't live in Maryland. They live down in, I think that's up in Delaware, I think is where they live. But in any event, probably nothing to read into at this point, but was very interesting with everything going on, all the talk about them maybe going to WWE, and all of a sudden the entire family pops up in the front row. Got a lot of people talking, that's for sure. Let's move on to the mailbag here. If you have any questions, you can email them to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. And you can actually now send in audio questions, those of you who wish to do so, MP3 format only, preferably no more than 30 seconds or so, give or take. And also in your email, if you do send an audio attachment, please include the text of your question in the body of the email as well. Let's go to our audio question of the week from my home state of New York.
Hey, what's up, Monster? This is Ray Vaughn Adamson from Harlem, New York. I have a question for you this week. Do you like the role that Curtis Axel is in right now, and do you think that he'll be a main event player in the near future?
Do I like the role that Curtis Axel is in right now? Yeah, I do, actually, for two reasons. One, he got to drop that shitty McGillicuddy name. Not that Curtis Axel is a huge improvement, but it's light years better than Michael McGillicuddy. And two, they're finally doing something with him. You know, I can't say that I look at the guy and think future world champ in the near future, but they see something in him, and he's got the pedigree, second-generation guy. Can't think of a better guy to take after than his father. At least he's off NXT and actually being used on television. Being aligned with Paul Heyman can only help him. It certainly isn't going to hurt. As far as him being a main event player in the near future, no. There's plenty of other guys who deserve a spot in the main event before he does. Let him work for it. You know, I'm still not convinced he belongs there yet. He's got time to prove himself worthy, so let him work at it. Robin from Tampa, Florida. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the loan system in soccer. Fairly simple concept. You purchase a player and then loan him to another team while retaining him contractually. After hearing your thoughts on Cody Rhodes and how perhaps time is running out for him, what are your thoughts on a loan system for WWE where they could loan talent to the likes of TNA, ROH, or perhaps the Japanese market with a precursor that said talent must be used in certain ways? So they have to be, for example, a heel or used in a tag team or a main event position. Though Cody might not be the ideal candidate, there are surely plenty of other people WWE could send. Also, WWE could cover a certain percentage of the wages, which would help TNA right now. Well, first of all, that's a pipe dream right there. They ain't going to help TNA. Why would WWE want to help TNA? TNA is very low competition for them, but they're still competition. TNA is on Spike TV, Raw's on USA. Why would they want to have anything to do with TNA? I know Dixie Carter apparently would love to do some sort of inter-promotional thing with WWE. I don't know what she's smoking, but yeah, no, they're not going to help TNA. They're not going to help ROH either, but you know, ROH, at least I could see maybe there being something. I think I made that comment once before where I thought WWE actually should contract with Ring of Honor and almost make ROH like a developmental system for them or a feeder system, because for so long there was so much good talent being turned out by ROH, and ROH has a lot of good guys there now, but I mean, it's nothing like it used to be. I mean, they had a lot of really good talent, some of the best talent in the indies. And now Ring of Honor is not quite what it used to be. But Ring of Honor also now, unlike before, has the backing of a multi-million dollar television conglomerate. They're on television now, and once you go on TV, you become a competitor to WWE. Doesn't matter what TV station it is, if you're not on in every single market in the country. Once they got on television, they became an enemy of the state. So I wouldn't expect them to do anything with ROH either. Japan is an interesting one. Japan I could see that. You know, I could see WWE coming to some sort of agreement with like a New Japan or an All Japan or something like that. It certainly couldn't hurt to send some of these guys they're not doing anything with over to Japan for a few months at a time to wrestle over there, learn the style, have some really competitive matches with some veterans and learn from them, and then make their way back here a more well-rounded performer. I don't know how it would work as far as, you know, what WWE would be able to tell, let's say, All Japan, hey, you have to use this guy in a certain way. I don't think they would buy into that. You know, this guy has to be in main events. It don't work that way. WWE did something like this already with the old ECW, as we found out later on. I mean, they were sending talent. For example, you know, Al Snow. Al Snow was a guy in WWF back in the mid-90s who was going nowhere. They brought him in. They put him in a mask. He played this character of Avatar, which was a complete flop. They put him under like a ninja mask as Shinobi, the Black Ninja, for a few shows, and that was a joke. And then they put him in that new Rockers tag team as this goofball guy stuck in the 80s as Leaf Cassidy. And they had some, I can't even say mild success. I mean, you know, whatever. They got on television. But it's not like he got over as a star. Somewhere after that, he went to ECW. And it was in ECW under Paul Heyman where Snow got the head gimmick. He started running around with a mannequin head. He got over. I don't know if anybody expected it to get over, but it got over big time. So once he got over and he found the character that actually worked for him, he ended up back in the WWF. It was almost like this unwritten talent exchange that they had. And there were ECW guys as well that popped up on Raw. Rob Van Dam wrestled Jeff Hardy in a match on Raw back in 1997. So there was some relationship like that, and it wasn't a success for everybody. Remember there was a guy on WWF television that they were hyping called Brockus, this German guy, this big, roided-up, freaked-out German-looking guy. And they had these promos saying Brockus is coming. Well, Brockus, I think, had one match, literally one match on Raw in 1998. I think before that, or maybe it was after that. He went down to ECW. He sucked. He was no good. So he went away. He didn't last. But Al Snow's a great example of somebody who was going nowhere, went to ECW, I believe while he was still under contract to WWF, and when he was finally getting over, they brought him back. So we've seen this before. It could work. It definitely is something that could work. WWE, though, they don't play well with others. I mean, when was the last time they had any sort of working relationship with another wrestling organization? I can't even think. It was probably... I'm trying to think now. You probably would have to go back to ECW in the mid to late 90s. And I think they may have also had some sort of relationship with the AAA promotion down in Mexico, because that Rumble in 1997, they brought in a lot of Mexican talent. Cibernético, and they had Mil Máscaras in the Rumble. They did some stuff with the Mexican Minis at one point, who were from, I forgot which promotion, probably AAA. That was probably the last time I can remember WWE working together. Any sort of working relationship with another wrestling company. It's just, it's not something they do. I like the concept of the loan system. I could see TNA doing that. And they have, also, I think, with AAA. I can't see WWE doing it. John from New York. My question is regarding WCW War Games. I wonder why WWE has never tried to capitalize on this concept for one of their B-level pay-per-views. Instead, we get shows like Capital Punishment, Fatal 4-Way, Night of Champions, which is ridiculous because the last pay-per-view, Payback, all titles were on the line. So this aspect is dead. Why not bring War Games back as a WWE pay-per-view? It's very simple. Vince McMahon doesn't want War Games. That's why we never got it. It wasn't his idea. We ended up with the Elimination Chamber instead. Triple H was a fan of the War Games, but Vince McMahon was not. And what Vince wants, Vince gets. What he doesn't want, we all don't get. Jim Ross, in one of his recent blogs, made a very interesting argument for why he doesn't want War Games brought back in WWE, or why he doesn't think it should be brought back. He said the violent nature of the match wouldn't work well in today's PG environment. I assume he's talking about the no blood and all that. It's a valid point. I still say there's no reason not to bring War Games back as the feature attraction at Survivor Series. I've been saying this for years. It even fits with the name, War Games at Survivor Series. You know, you look at the traditional Big Four pay-per-views, right? Rumble, Mania, SummerSlam, Survivor Series. Survivor Series is the one that has suffered and fallen the most. The show is on life support. I mean, Vince McMahon canceled it altogether a few years ago. And then he changed his mind, brought it back. Why not build to a 4-on-4 or 5-on-5 match, two rings, enclosed by a cage, one fall to a finish? You can build up all the singles matches you want. Have a normal pay-per-view, but the main event is a 5-on-5 War Games match. Two rings in the cage. You need the two rings for this to work. Otherwise, don't even bother. And I know they may not want to sacrifice the money those ringside tickets would bring in, because those are the most expensive seats, and now you're adding a ring. You're taking away precious space at ringside. I get that. So just charge more money then for the other tickets at ringside. And on top of that, if you end up adding buys to Survivor Series because people actually like the War Games concept and they buy your show more than they did the year before, you probably end up making that money back up in the end anyway. Then you got DVD sales that you can market around the whole War Games concept. You'll make that money back. I can never understand why. I'm with Triple H on this. It's just money being left on the table. The Elimination Chamber is fine. You know, I've grown to like the match. It's a cool match. It's not War Games. We've never had anything like two rings side by side. Such an interesting thing. And WWE never did it, I guess because WCW did it first. But they own all of it. The copyrights, I mean, the name, it's all theirs. And this notion that, well, you know, it's not our idea, so we're not going to use it. It's just, I always found that to be completely foolish. It's yours. Make money with it. Do something with it. And that would be the best way, in my opinion, to freshen up Survivor Series. Ian writes in, seems as though Ryback's character is left in limbo these days. How do you suppose WWE saves Ryback's lost character? I believe a win over Jericho at Money in the Bank could give him some momentum. Maybe then he could challenge a babyface world champion Dolph Ziggler. What are your thoughts on how to keep Ryback relevant, or is keeping him relevant even worth it anymore? I don't think it is. I think he's done. I said it earlier. I'm sure they'll find a role for him on the roster. He'll always be doing something. It shouldn't be challenging for a world title. Looks like they're doing a crybaby storyline with him now. Fine. Great. Let him be a little bitch, if that's what they want to do with him. Him beating Jericho at Money in the Bank isn't going to give him much momentum at all, because he's already dead. It makes no difference. Ben from Fresno, California. Here's an interesting thought. A wrestling off-season. I can see where this would help the business from the wrestlers, getting some time off to heal up and spend some time with friends and family. However, I also feel that wrestling companies can lose a lot of cash if they make this move. Do you think a pro wrestling off-season could help or hurt the business? Well, as I said to Ben off the air, I think it could help and hurt wrestling for all the obvious reasons. I would be in favor of trying it out right after WrestleMania. Even though those post-Mania Raw shows are usually better than WrestleMania itself, I would hate to give those up. Yeah, they could even keep it. Keep the Raw after WrestleMania. Use that show as a way to tease some new directions that you're going to go in for after the off-season ends. So maybe it lasts a month, 2 months. You know, but I mean, that's the thing. They can't afford to have an off-season that stretches for much longer than that. Another viable option, just throwing this out there, and this may be better, is just to rotate guys out one at a time, which is something TNA does to some degree, although that's largely because they can't afford to fly everybody in for the tapings. And I guess in some other cases, they probably just don't have anything creatively for half those guys. So instead of just completely taking off for a couple of months, you can take a guy like a Ryback or a Kofi Kingston or Randy Orton, and you mandate that at a given point in the year, they're off television and house shows for X number of weeks. It could be 3 weeks all at once, maybe a month, or maybe you give them the option to space it out, take 2 weeks at a time here and there over the course of the year. Of course, I'm sure you won't have very many happy wrestlers who are pleased about, you know, losing money. And USA Network would never ever go for a total blackout of WWE programming for weeks on end if you do a proper off-season. That's the other thing that you have to keep in mind. There really is no simple solution here. The current system, as it was designed many years ago, it simply does not account for any type of downtime. They take pride. Hey, 51 weeks or 52 weeks out of the year, we're always on the air. It would require a complete overhaul of how WWE operates and how the contracts with their broadcast partners are structured. I don't think we ever see an offseason in WWE. I don't think that ever happens. But I think rotating talent in and out is something that they should already be doing. This comes to us from Paul. Like you, I am a fan of the Kane character, and I was taken with your recent idea of Libertarian Kane. Would you have him come out as the Kane character with mask, or would you have him take the mask off and use his real name or a variation thereof? This being WWE, it would probably be something like Jacob Glenn. The character could evolve out of a WWE skit where they have a wrestler doing things one would not expect them to be associated with, like Kane giving his political views. Other ideas for such informative segments could include The Art of Public Speaking with Brock Lesnar, Successful Dieting with The Big Show, How to Cook the Perfect Steak with Daniel Bryan, Modern Fashion with The Champ, John Cena, How to Have a Happy Marriage with Ric Flair, or Making the Perfect Cocktail with CM Punk. Okay, all of those have to happen first before I even answer this. If they can green light these lame-ass 1-800-fella skits for Sheamus, then why the hell can't we have some of these? Do them as, like, funny commercials, like the ones ESPN does for SportsCenter. I think that is a fantastic idea. And as far as Libertarian Kane is concerned, I think it's funnier if he keeps the mask, but otherwise just dresses like somebody, like when he was at the Ron Paul barbecue, those pictures came out, he was dressed like a normal person. He had like a button-down shirt open over a t-shirt. I think that just makes it funnier. Somebody else on Twitter asked me this week, since John Cena's FU was renamed the AA, what would Libertarian Kane's chokeslam be called? And my answer is very simple. The flat tax. This shit sells itself. See, when Kane is done doing whatever it is that Kane does, whether he's comedy Kane or vicious, sadistic Kane, when his run is truly coming to a close, this gimmick can add like 3 years onto his career. I'm just saying.
History has been made here!
It's time to take a look back at this past week in wrestling history. It was 44 years ago this week on July 2nd, 1969, that Iron Mike DiBiase, the father of the Million Dollar Man Ted DiBiase, suffered a heart attack in the ring during a match against Man Mountain Mike. Harley Race was there. He realized what was going on. He performed CPR on DiBiase, traveled with him to the hospital, where he was pronounced dead. He was only 45 years old. 25 years ago this week, on July 4, 1988, adorable Adrian Adonis, who used to be tag team partners with Jesse Ventura as the East-West Connection in the NWA and later competed in WWF, lost his hair in a match with Roddy Piper at WrestleMania 3. He was killed in a car accident in Canada, along with two other wrestlers, when a fourth wrestler, the only one to survive the accident, allegedly swerved to avoid hitting a moose and drove into a lake. 22 years ago this week, on July 1st, 1991, Ric Flair, who was the NWA champion at the time and the biggest star in WCW, in a shocking move, he was fired by Executive VP Jim Herd. Flair and Herd, they clashed a lot. Herd believed that Flair should be phased down in favor of other stars, younger stars like Sting and Lex Luger. And Jim Herd, who had previously served as a manager for Pizza Hut, even came up with the bright idea to have Ric Flair cut his hair and adopt a gimmick as Spartacus, which thankfully never happened. Flair, who had paid a $25,000 deposit on the world belt, the big gold belt, as was customary back in the day when you were the champion, he was still in possession of the title. He refused to give it up unless his deposit was paid back with interest. And Jim Herd basically told him to go screw. And Flair had the last laugh. He signed with Vince McMahon and showed up on WWF television 2 months later with the big gold belt. Jim Herd was fired by WCW a few months later, and he was replaced by Kip Fry. 20 years ago this week, it was July 4, 1993, aboard the USS Intrepid here in New York, WWF had an event that was designed to basically launch their next big babyface. Lex Luger had been a heel on television. He was portraying the role of the Narcissus, this guy that was just completely obsessed with himself. He always looked at himself in the mirror and posed, and he would knock out his opponents with what they claim was a metal plate in his forearm. Now, Luger had been in a really bad motorcycle wreck the year before, and he actually did have plates, I think, and screws put in his forearm, but this whole concept that, you know, by hitting people in the head with his forearm, it was knocking them out. So silly. Even when I was a kid, I thought the whole thing was silly. So that was what Luger was doing. Hulk Hogan had just left the company, and they needed that next big babyface, and they made the decision to turn Luger face, and they used this event to springboard it. So they brought in these sports figures and celebrities. They had Bill Frelick, who was a football player, and I think that Russ Francis was another football player. They had wrestlers, Bob Backlund, Tatanka, the Steiner Brothers, Crush, the Macho Man, all of them were trying to body slam Yokozuna. Some people got Yoko off his feet a little bit. Some people couldn't even do that. And nobody could do it. And when all looked like it was for nothing, things looked bleak, Yokozuna won. All of a sudden, a helicopter comes flying in. Helicopter lands aboard the Intrepid, and it's Lex Luger wearing, I think he was wearing some sort of red, white, and blue t-shirt. Kids were like all around him cheering him on. It's so cheesy. But I actually love this. It, like, I wish WWF or WWE would do some event like this in the future. I mean, how cool is it to have wrestling on board the Intrepid? I mean, come on. So Luger got in the ring. They squared off. We all know what happened next. He body slammed Yokozuna. Everyone cheered. Everybody celebrated. And then he went on a bus tour across the country, went to SummerSlam, and he won by countout. So in the end, he didn't even win the championship. He was a loser, was Lex Luger. And that's why he never got over in WWE. So yeah, that happened 20 years ago this week. On July 4th the following year, WWF referee Joey Morella, the adopted son of Hall of Famer Gorilla Monsoon, was killed in a single car accident on the New Jersey Turnpike after a WWE taping in Maryland. It was a TV taping. He fell asleep at the wheel. Harvey Whippleman apparently was in the seat next to him. Whippleman was pretty badly hurt, but he was wearing his seatbelt, which probably saved his life. Unfortunately, Morella was not wearing his seatbelt at the time that he died. 17 years ago this week, on July 7, 1996, Bash at the Beach, WCW pay-per-view down in Daytona Beach, Kevin Nash and Scott Hall were the invading faction. They had come over from WWF only about a couple of months before, and they were being portrayed on television as invaders from WWF. Although on the Great American Bash pay-per-view the month before, because of legal reasons, Eric Bischoff had to point-blank ask them if they were here on behalf of the World Wrestling Federation, and they said no. But still, the whole thing was portrayed as, these guys are coming up, they're coming down from up north, they're trying to take over. It was a very clever angle on the part of Eric Bischoff. And going into the pay-per-view, they threatened to unveil a third man. They were going to unveil a mystery partner to take on Sting, Lex Luger, and the Macho Man in a six-man tag team main event. And we all know how it turned out. Hulk Hogan comes walking out in the red and yellow. Bobby Heenan kind of spoils it on commentary by saying, you know, whose side is he on? Which he was not supposed to say. Eric Bischoff was very upset that Heenan essentially gave it away. I think even in later releases, even on like the WWE releases, I think they actually dub out Heenan's commentary when he said that. But, you know, whatever. Heenan always hated Hogan on television, so naturally it made sense for Heenan to doubt his intentions. And he was right. Hulk Hogan dropped the big leg on Randy Savage, turned his back on WCW, aligned himself with Hall and Nash, and it was that night that the NWO was born. And it led to a boom period in wrestling. It led to a boom period certainly for WCW, the most successful period in the history of that company. And it forced WWF to, you know, it lit a fire under their ass is what it did. And you could argue that it started with the NWO, which led to better things for WWE as well, and led to Austin vs. McMahon, which in the end was able to launch them ahead of WCW. But really, I would say that the angle as it unfolded at Bash at the Beach with Hogan's heel turn and the debut of the NWO, it changed wrestling forever. I won't say that it changed wrestling just for those 3 or 4 years. I think that changed the history of professional wrestling, at least in this country, forever. And the reason I say that is because we're now in the year 2013. And in the year 2013, people are still longing, they're begging for that next big angle, for that next big star, for the next big boom period. And how many times have we seen people try to recreate, whether it's WWE or TNA, or even ROH to a lesser degree? I mean, yeah, there have always been factions in wrestling. But the way, you know, the Main Event Mafia or the Nexus as this invading faction, how many times have we seen companies try to recreate the magic that the original NWO had. I don't even know. I mean, I've lost track of how many times they've tried to duplicate that. You can't duplicate that. It's like capturing lightning in a bottle. You can only do it once. And so even today, people are trying to recreate the magic of that period, sometimes with disastrous results. And it affects everything we see on television even now, because people still remember that period in the late 90s, whether it was the NWO, Austin versus McMahon, the dynamic between the two of them, the Attitude Era, all of that. We are still living in a day and age where we're trying to recreate that. And I don't know that that's such a good thing, because I don't think we can ever recreate that. Because back then, it was just a different time. You were able to, you know, be more realistic about it. And you didn't have the kind of handcuffs I think you have today. Everything's all PC today and PG. PG and PC are the two things, I think, above all else, that and probably a lack of creativity, that will prevent us from ever getting back to a level like that again. So it's not really, you know, being overly dramatic to say that this angle on this day 17 years ago changed wrestling forever, and not necessarily for the better. But for those of us who were fans back then, it was certainly a hell of a time to be a wrestling fan. 12 years ago this week, on July 2nd, 2001, here's another big one. It was the long-awaited debut of the new WCW. Monday Night Raw was in Tacoma, Washington. And the idea was they were going to give the last, I guess, segment or the last half hour or so of Monday Night Raw. It was going to turn into a WCW show. They got JR, I guess it would have been JR and Paul Heyman, out of the announce booth. The new announce team for the last half hour was Scott Hudson, who had been one of WCW's play-by-play guys at the end, and Arn Anderson was there to provide some color commentary and analysis. The main event was Buff Bagwell against Booker T, which I believe was a WCW title match. It might have been a WCW title match. So Booker T and Buff Bagwell are in the ring. They're having a match, and the crowd craps all over the match. They hate the match. They're chanting boring. They're sitting on their hands. These guys are doing rest holds. I think, you know, Buff's got Booker, and like, I haven't watched the match in so long, but if I remember, he had him in like a reverse chin lock for a while. And here's the thing, you know, based on even what I remember of the match, I'm not going to say that it was the worst match of all time, because it wasn't. Pretty far from it. The problem is that that was not the match those two guys needed to have on that night. Those two guys had to go in there and blow everybody away. And Booker T, I think, certainly could have done that. Buff Bagwell, I always thought was overrated. He had a good look, I guess, sure. I always thought he was more athletic earlier in his career, you know, when he was Marcus Alexander Bagwell and doing the American Male stuff with Scotty Riggs. Then he got all jacked up and he hurt his neck, and he wasn't as good physically in the ring as he used to be. He was, you know, they say Buff is the stuff. Well, Buff was fluff here on this night. He didn't do much. And the crowd crapped all over it. Vince McMahon was backstage. Apparently, he was furious. He hated it. He hated how this segment turned out and how the crowd was reacting to it. And that was when the decision was made. We're not doing a new WCW. That's it. The whole plan, they had been planning for weeks, for months. They were going to launch WCW as its own brand. The idea was they were actually going to give Monday Night Raw to WCW. And I guess SmackDown would become the WWE show. That was the plan. They were drawing up rosters for who would be where, who would be the announcers for the new WCW. They were really going to move forward with this, and they put these guys out there. And I think part of it also was, for years, you know, WWF always portrayed WCW as the enemy. They're the bad guys. And so now WCW is taking over, and you expect the WWF audience to embrace them. I think that was flawed. I think that was, you know, that line of thinking, it was never going to work out that way. I wouldn't have given up so quickly. I mean, then again, I wouldn't have put Buff Bagwell in the first WCW match. But I wouldn't have given up so quickly. They left a lot of money on the table by not doing this the right way. I've talked about the whole invasion storyline, and they didn't bother bringing in all the top names and everything. But this is where it died. This is where WCW truly died. In Tacoma, Washington. Could you imagine if in that last half hour of the show, they loaded it up first with a cruiserweight match, like the cruiserweight matches that used to open up Nitro back in the day? I always considered myself a WWF guy more than a WCW guy, but I would watch those cruiserweight matches and be blown away by what I was seeing. I wanted to see that on Raw. And they tried. They had this light heavyweight division, but you know, it was never anything compared to the cruiserweights in WCW. So why not start that last half hour out with a cruiserweight match and then build to a main event with two big names from WCW? Booker T, if you want Booker T in there, but they should have splurged to sign somebody else. They should have signed a big name that they could put in there in that first main event, whether it's a Goldberg or a DDP or somebody along those lines, and put your best foot forward. You know, you only get one shot to make a good first impression. People weren't impressed. They're not impressed when they're chanting boring and this match sucks. And that's what officially killed WCW. Took place 12 years ago this week. Lastly, 8 years ago this week, July 4th, Independence Day back in 2005, Raw featured a main event of Shawn Michaels and Hulk Hogan as tag team partners against the team of Kurt Angle and Carlito. Michaels and Hogan were victorious, posing after the match when all of a sudden Shawn Michaels delivered some sweet chin music out of nowhere. He knocked Hulk Hogan the F out. Left him laying. Crowd was booing. It was the first signs of a heel Shawn Michaels character since before his back surgery, all those years before. And Michaels basically had about a month and a half, where he played the role of heel. It didn't last long. He was never kind of a full-fledged heel. And as soon as the Hogan match was over, Michaels just went back to doing what he was doing before. So it was a shame because Shawn Michaels, I think, was always at his most entertaining as a heel. But it was the super kick heard around the world, kicking Hulk Hogan in the face, although we all know how that turned out. And that happened 8 years ago this week. So there you go. That's This Week in Wrestling History. If you have questions for the Sound Off, please email them to me, including audio questions. TheSolomonster at gmail.com is the place to send all inquiries. You can follow me on Twitter as well, at Solomonster. I put a whole bunch of photos from the TNA event on Friday night up on Facebook as well as Twitter. There's actually a full photo album on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSolomonster, but you can find them on Twitter as well. And please don't forget to subscribe to this podcast in iTunes. You can also listen to it through Stitcher Radio. And you can find all the episodes archived on thesolomonster.com, where you can also make a PayPal donation, which I would be very much appreciative of if you are able to do so and spare whatever you can. You'll see a little PayPal donate box on the right-hand side of the page. Scroll down a little bit and can give whatever you want. I really appreciate it. That's going to do it for episode 282. I want to thank you all for listening this week. Next weekend is episode 283. We're going to be on the road. We're taking the Sound Off on the road to Philadelphia. I will be there with Noah Mark. We will do our Money in the Bank pay-per-view predictions, have any other breaking last-minute news that there may be. The idea is that we'll get the show up probably late morning, early afternoon that Sunday. Should be a lot of fun. I look forward to heading over to the City of Brotherly Love for the Money in the Bank pay-per-view. Got a pretty good lineup. So until then, be well, stay safe, enjoy your week. Hopefully we will see you right back here next weekend for our special Money in the Bank edition of the Sound Off right here on Stitcher Radio and SEScoops.com.
You've been listening to the Solomonster Sounds Off, giving you the good. The bad.
Raw is now 3 hours every Monday at 8.
And the ugly.
Hello. Why does Jerry Lawler insist on telling us that we are just getting started? The fuck have I been watching for the past 2 hours?
Well, mostly the good.
I don't want to K-fab you.
You're going to K-fab me?
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007 on SEScoops.com, TheSolomonster.com, and Stitcher Radio, The Solomonster Sounds Off.